Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do it. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
Mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too. Like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hello, and welcome to the Randomly Generated History Club, where three non-historians pick a year at random and try to learn things about it. I'm Anna, and I'm here with my two friends, Ant and Will.
Hello.
Hello.
This week, we have returned from the BCE times, and we're back to comparative modernity with the year 1818. And as is our tradition, I'd like each of us to give a three-word preview of what we'll be discussing today. Ant?
My three words are, you should have listened.
Should have.
Should've. One word.
Yeah, okay.
I'll absolutely allow it. I also have to say, I really appreciate the creativity you're taking with your three words. Mm-hmm. I feel like every week we're pushing the boundaries a little
more.
Well,
I was going to just have another three words, which are just the same word, which was ice, ice, ice. Or potentially ice, ice, baby.
I was going to say, would you consider ice, ice, baby?
So now I've given you seven words,
yeah,
and I apologize. No, actually, I've only given you the six.
You can't...
Five.
You can't get around the three-word limit by simply saying the things that you would have considered as an alternative.
I feel like we've invented the rules ourselves, and we're just holding ourselves to the standard. Or are we saying that the random number generator has some sort of will and power over us?
These are the rules we inherited as stewards of the club traditions.
From this Grover Cleveland himself.
This is true. I should just really just check myself before.
My three words are resistance to genocide.
Are you pro or con? Anti.
I am pro resistance.
Good. Great. My three words are Hamilton, Burr, Washington.
Can you spell Burr?
B-U-R-R.
Oh, so not cold.
Huh.
Yeah, not in the way you might suspect. But I'm starting today, so we'll just get straight to that.
I have seen this musical.
Yes,
so
good. Yeah.
I'll know everything about
it. I'm just going to sing it straight through. That's my bit today.
I'm excited.
Great. Here we go. 1818. All right, so today I'm in South America, which in 1818 is in the middle of a very long independence movement happening kind of throughout Central and South America. And a little bit of background to set the scene is that in 1808, Napoleon deposes Ferdinand VII, the King of Spain, and installs his brother Joseph Bonaparte, Napoleon's brother, on the throne. This kicks off a ton of debate within Spain about the monarchy versus liberalism and what the people of Spain want for themselves. That debate soon spreads to the Spanish colonies overseas, specifically in Central and South America, and it's basically the match that lights the powder keg. Soon there are independence movements breaking out all over the shop.
So Joey Boney's in charge.
Joey Boney's in charge.
What was Napoleon's first name? His the actual Napoleon.
What?
The actual Napoleon.
Wasn't his name Napoleon?
Bonaparte. Oh, yeah. That's it. Never mind.
Yes, it wasn't Steve Napoleon.
I just had an absolute brain fart there because I was like, oh yeah, Joe Bonaparte. What was Napoleon's first name? Oh, God.
Yes, good. So Joey Boney's in charge and Nappy Boney's doing his things in Europe. But it's important to note that even as this independence movement spread through Central and South America, a lot of the movements just had the goal of preserving autonomy from France. They weren't necessarily thinking about fully escaping the Spanish monarchy. So it wasn't like independence for independence's sake. And some of the leaders of the movements in various places wanted to keep a monarchy in place. So that's just an interesting contextual bit to keep in your mind. We're not immediately throwing off the yoke of the monarchy.
Well, good.
Yeah.
I mean, and you're right that most people that seek independence just do it for the sake of independence.
Yeah.
To try something new.
Yeah, they've got no actual other.
Just give it a whirl. Test drive.
What do you mean, yoke?
1K, no L, 1E.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I think what Will is trying to say here is.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I forgot that I had an extreme pro monarchist in there.
Yeah, yeah.
But this is I'm talking about the Spanish monarchy,
Will.
Which you are famously anti.
Oh, it's terrible yoke.
Yeah.
Horrendous. Cast it off.
Yeah. You know you're never going to be king, right? Just of anything. Just putting that out there.
Never say never.
Yeah, I wouldn't bet against him. Okay, so today I'm focusing on the Captaincy General of Chile, which was one of the smallest and poorest colonies in the empire. And I'm going to give you guys a whistle-stop tour of their independence movement, which is split into three parts, the Patria Vieja, the Reconquista, and the Patria Nueva. So the first one, the Patria Vieja, which means like the old homeland, the first step is taken by Chileans in 1810 when they form the Government Assembly of the Kingdom of Chile, also known as the First Junta. And I'm going to say junta so many times today.
What does junta mean?
Junta, well, it's like a government by like a group of people.
Okay.
So like juntos means together. So I think a junta is like a government.
Okay.
That's why you hear it like a military junta, because the military takes over.
Right, yeah, because you kind of often hear it in sort of negative context.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But I think, it's not necessarily negative. And in this case, it's a very, you'll see, it's a very sort of democratic way. So this first junta is established as a way to govern themselves while Ferdinand VII is being held by Nappy Boney. but from the get-go, there's disagreement about who should be in charge. There are three factions, two different royalist factions, and then one relatively independent faction. But in the beginning, at least, the ultimate aim was to restore the legitimate Spanish throne and take it away from Joey Boney.
Jimmy Bones. Good old King Jimmy Bones.
Because he used to be Napoleon Bonaparte, wasn't he? And then he just reduced it to Napoleon for his second album.
Yeah, yeah.
And then he
the artist formerly known as Napoleon.
His brother's jazz guitarist, Jimmy Bones.
Right, exactly. And now he's Joe Bones.
Yeah, now he's Joe Bones. And Napoleon is now represented just by a hat.
Right,
that's
exactly.
That's the symbol of him. So ultimately, the first junta ends. There's a national congress. There's a second junta. There's democracy, blah, blah, blah. But the most important thing is that the cracks in the factions are starting to show, which means it's time to meet one of the main characters in today's story, José Miguel Carrera. He is a guy who is incredibly pro-Chile. He thinks Chile should be independent entirely. So he sees the second junta and everything that's come before it, and he basically thinks it's not sufficient. It's too deferential to Spain. He wants, boom, free state Chile. So he stages a coup and takes power in 1811. He does a bunch of things once he's in power, including abolishing slavery.
Yay.
We love that. And making the first Chilean flag.
Oh.
Not nearly as important, but also cool. Spain is pissed. They send the army and navy to come attack him, and he leaves his government post so that he can go be commander-in-chief of the patriotic forces. He has some successes, but then ultimately he has a few key losses, and he's relieved of his duty and Yes. And control of the army is given to the second main character of today's story,
Oh boy.
Here we go.
Bernardo O'Higgins.
No way.
I swear to God, this cannot be true. I swear to God, his name is Bernardo O'Higgins.
Some random redheaded guy just pops up and saying, yeah, I like chili.
Now, this is just a little bit about him because I have to explain why that's his name. He has Basque, Spanish, and a third heritage. Can anyone guess?
Oh, boy.
That's right. He's Irish.
Wow.
So his family comes from a very prominent Irish family.
The O'Higgins.
The O'Higginses.
Oh, that's the link with them.
Yeah. Who they had all of their possessions confiscated by Oliver Cromwell back in the day.
Absolute classic.
Yeah.
You know, you could just say that about any Irish family,
yeah,
really.
Because they refused to, like, kowtow to the parliamentarians. So Cromwell took all their possessions away. And then a lot of them moved to Spain because they felt that they could make a better life for themselves kind of in that realm.
Joey Bones, so the door is wide open.
I did not know this.
Yeah. Well, I won't talk too much about it because it is well off the 1818. Hmm. But eventually, O'Higgins of today's story has made it to the colonies, and he's becoming a very prominent force in Chile. So he is given control of the army and just quickly has risen through the ranks. Now, it's helpful to think about O'Higgins and Carrera as frenemies. Mm-hmm. And there's actually really strong parallels. You think about Carrera as the Aaron Burr to O'Higgins's Hamilton.
Oh, okay. Gotcha.
They kind of started out as teammates, and then there's some schisms that happen. And
was it like really passive aggressive, where it's like, oh, Higgins, oh, that's a wonderful cape. It's so brave that you're wearing that.
Yeah.
Like, you know, most people couldn't. Yeah.
Well, I think suffice it to say, I'm going to write a musical called O'Higgins that's going to be as successful as Hamilton, if not more so. Bernardo O'Higgins. It's just, it's right there.
You're going to need a few more lines.
No, it's just that for 4 hours. That's right. It's twice as long, too. So back to the timeline. The first phase ends in 1814 with the resounding defeat of the rebel forces at the Battle of Rancagua, which is also known as the Disaster of Rancagua, because only 500 out of 5,000 men survive. But despite the fact that O'Higgins is in charge of this, he is still seen as a good person, a good leader.
That doesn't sound like a very successful battle.
No, yeah. Well, that's why it's not called the glorious victory of Rancagua.
Okay.
So phase two is the Reconquista. The Spanish take back control. They kick off a campaign of incredibly fierce political persecution led by a man named Vicente San Bruno. But we don't talk about Bruno. That's a joke for people who have seen a movie that neither of you two have seen.
Nope, not seen it. Not seen it.
No idea what you're
anyway,
on about.
The Spanish exile the Chilean patriots to an island, but that only serves to rile them up. And all of a sudden, all the moderates who had been thinking like, maybe the monarchy's okay, have converted to like 100% fierce patriots, only independence will do. So a real classic backfire. There's guerrilla warfare in the mountains, in the Andes, and basically the rebels are gathering strength to come back against the Spanish. And now we meet our third main character, José de San Martín. And to extend the Hamilton metaphor, you can think about him as the George Washington.
Okay.
He is this incredibly well-respected figure across South and Central America. He's been involved in a lot of the freedom movements, independence movements so far. He and O'Higgins immediately hit it off and start to kind of exclude Carrera, who's moving in his own direction, ultimately gets exiled, goes to Argentina and tries to kickstart their independence movement. And his Carrera's resentment against O'Higgins is just festering this whole time.
To what extent? I don't really understand any of the history around here at all. Like, so if you're Chilean at the time, do you see yourself as a very distinct kind of thing to Argentinian people? Like, have nationhood? Has that like emerged at this point? Based on,
I don't think it's. I mean, I think it has emerged, but not in any sort of anti way. Like,
right.
If you're Chilean, you don't hate the Argentinians necessarily, but you are separated by a pretty big mountain chain. So
yeah.
I think there's no some of the later freedom fighters like Bolivar and even San Martin have this more of this idea about like a pan-American movement.
Right.
But a lot of the countries are like, hey, we got to sort ourselves out first and then we'll think about that.
And was O'Higgins saying we should wait for it?
How many Hamilton puns are you going to make?
Will, have you seen Hamilton?
I have, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, wait for that song where Burr is classically reticent to do anything.
I got it. I thought it was really funny. Really
good. Good.
Yeah. Very, very good joke.
This is being left in.
So you may say that at the Battle of Chacabuco, San Martin and O'Higgins were in the room where it happens. And by that, I mean that we're on the battlefield where it happens.
Of Chacabuco.
Chacabuco.
Great, great sounding word.
Yeah, it's absolutely great word. So that battle is in 1817, and San Martin and O'Higgins win a decisive victory against the Spanish. They re-enter Santiago as the conquering heroes. San Martin is proclaimed supreme director of Chile, but he declines the position because he wants to focus on liberating the rest of South America. And he gives the job to O'Higgins instead. So Bernardo O'Higgins is the supreme director of Chile. And he stays in that post until 1823.
Hmm.
And then just to kind of close this out here, phase three is Patria Nueva. So this is Chile now has a government with its own authority, its own flag, coat of arms, currency. It's a de facto independent state. But it hasn't actually made an explicit declaration of independence. Instead, O'Higgins holds a plebiscite so the people can decide whether or not they want to declare independence. And that goes pretty well. And on February 12th, 1818, the first anniversary of the Battle of Chacabuco, O'Higgins formally declares independence for Chile.
Incredible.
Nice.
And it's great. The Spanish are just like, yay, fine.
No.
No, that's not what happens. They are miffed, I would say, and they kick off a new round of fighting. There are more battles throughout 1818 led by San Martin, ultimately culminating in a decisive victory for the independence movement. But just as an interesting postscript, here we have the return of Aaron Burr, a.k.a. Jose Miguel Carrera. He's been exiled, but he gathered strength and he ultimately returned to Chile to attack O'Higgins. He was arrested by O'Higgins's supporters. There was a show trial, and then Carrera was executed, quote, under questionable circumstances in 1821. And this kind of, it's not like it is the final, you know, nail in the coffin for O'Higgins, but enough people are like, that wasn't handled well, that O'Higgins kind of reads the room and decides to step down from his post. And it was described as, quote, typically dramatic. Baring his chest, he offered up his life should his accusers demand it of him. And in return, the junta declared that they held nothing against O'Higgins. And saluted him.
What? This is like they were talking about him behind his back, and then he's confronted them, and he's like, and they're like, "Oh no, we think you're really cool."
They're like, "Nah, it's fine. You just, you know, maybe don't be director anymore." And so,
but it's also like a bit melodramatic, isn't it? He's basically coming in and saying, "Take my life if you must," and they're basically responding, "No. Like, just can you just leave? I mean, like, this is not. We're not going to kill you. Yeah. Like, just leave, please."
This is how I do all my business meetings.
Right. Yeah.
We've been meaning to talk to you about that.
Let me take my shirt off.
Really unprofessional.
Well, you can take my life if you want.
Take my life or take my PowerPoint slides. So anyway, he leaves Chile, and he actually never returns. As it turns out, he dies when he's gathering up his strength to return to Chile. His like physical strength, he gets quite ill. Two notes on his legacy. In 1955, the football team O'Higgins FC was founded.
Nice.
And I am now a huge supporter of O'Higgins FC. And the Order of Bernardo O'Higgins is Chile's highest award for foreign citizens.
That's incredible.
That's really interesting.
And I expect to win it any day now.
I was wondering, is there like a long legacy of O'Higginses in Chile? Is there a large like,
yeah, clan? So I think there were a couple, because he definitely had kids. But
Well, yeah, if he's baring his chest the whole time, he's going to get some attention from the ladies.
He's going to get some attention. But yeah, I don't think, you know, I don't think the president of Chile right now is named O'Higgins, but, you know.
There's no way of knowing.
there's no way of knowing.
If the president of Chile could please email in.
Yeah, if you are the president of Chile. Yeah.
Holding up a copy of today's newspaper and your passport.
Yeah, we'd love to hear from you. Also, if you want to hit up that Patreon while you're at it, president of Chile, I imagine you've got the scratch.
Oh, yeah. And also the awards for the Bernardo Award. Just swing them our way.
Shortlist all three of those. That's good. Yeah, so that's just one bit of the independence movement happening in South America. I imagine we'll get to other bits at other times.
Oh, yeah.
But that was Chile.
There's a lot of stuff happening the whole time.
Yeah. In history, as we've discussed.
In history, as we discussed, yeah. So today, for my part of 1818, I am going to be talking about the exploration and the attempted discovery of the Northwest Passage.
Mm. Dun, dun, dun.
Yes, dun, 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 indeed.
Ooh.
So the Northwest Passage is the sea route between the Atlantic and the Pacific Oceans through the Arctic Ocean. So in the north, top of America, that kind of side of things.
Like towards the Northwest?
Towards the Northwest. It is a passage through the Northwest.
Wow, okay.
I've wasted a lot of time.
It's clear now.
So this was a much sought after route that was a shortcut between Europe and Asia for centuries beforehand, because from the Arctic to the, you know, to the southernmost tip of South America, it's just useless land with nothing to trade and nothing of merit there whatsoever. And so they wanted a shortcut into Asia. Because as we know, the Americas has no natural riches.
Yeah, California sucks. Nothing there.
Yeah, exactly. The name the Northwest Passage actually existed before confirmation of its existence existed.
Ooh. We're getting really metaphysical.
So the English declared or hoped to discover the Northwest Passage without knowing that it was indeed there.
Okay.
There was a lot of speculation about it. Did it exist? Didn't exist? There was even things like they argued that Arctic seawater didn't freeze. This was backed up by James Cook, famous Captain Cook. He took some chippings off an iceberg and it turned out to be fresh water. And he sort of propagated this myth.
Hang on. By taking water off of a frozen iceberg, he propagated the myth that Arctic water doesn't freeze.
No, Arctic seawater doesn't freeze.
Gotcha.
So what's the implication? So the implication of that is that
deterring people like, you know, like trying to drum up support and money for this was could be seen as a fool errand and as a political football a little bit.
Nice.
And the expeditions up until this point from the Norse all the way along has been largely ended in icy disaster.
Yeah.
Until 1818. This time, it would be different.
Uh-huh.
Because it would end in a different kind of disaster.
It would end in a different kind of disaster. Exactly. So in 1818, the hero of the story, Captain John Ross, charged by the Admiralty to take his naval ships Isabella and the Alexander, who was captained by Captain Edward Parry, and told to go forth and discover. So he made a beeline for Baffin Bay in Canada with the hope of ferreting his way through the north and onto the Bering Strait that exists between Alaska and Russia. Famously, you can see right across it.
from Sarah Palin's house.
Yeah. He had lots of stores and provisions with him, as you might expect.
Seems sensible.
It's very sensible. He had all the usuals, the liniments, the oils.
He's like, oh, we're back to the tincture.
The tinctures. Oh, he was stocked with it. But there is one exciting new edition of a type of provision or store. Can you guess what it is?
In 1818.
1818. Just invented.
Well, based on your use of the word ferreting, I'm going to say they had actual ferrets on
board. Ice ferrets. Interesting.
Ice ferrets.
Is it some kind of explosive?
It is not. It is tinned food.
Ooh. Oh, interesting.
So canned tinned food was just discovered.
Uh-huh.
And it was such a new invention, they had not yet invented the can opener.
Is this true?
This is true. So they had tinned canned food, but they didn't have a can opener, so they just had to like mallet it open or something, or just jump in it and just let it just, you know, the spam just spurt all over the deck.
Just a rock.
Yeah, just a rock bashing it. Or maybe they just swallowed it whole and let the body digest the tin.
Tin. Tin, tin is good for you.
Yeah, it's
in
like slow
large
release.
Large amounts. Yeah.
Soup. So anyway, Ross gets to Baffin Bay and he starts probing a bit deeper into the Lancaster Sound. And then he spies some people on the shore running up and down the shore. And he thinks, oh, look, they're sailors in distress. They must have been shipwrecked one of these previous expeditions. And so he gets up closer and through his spyglass, he sees they're actually not sailors, but they are, indigenous people that are on this land that they didn't expect to find anywhere so
classic.
Far north.
Yeah.
So he makes to shore and he does the classic European explorer thing. And he put out gifts for them in order to parlay and chat.
Did the gifts include a bunch of tinned food cans that they couldn't open?
They actually did. And they also included things like European clothes because they saw what they're wearing. It's like, oh, that's not suitable clothing. It was the most suitable clothing in the climate.
Yeah.
And they also proffered the very classic gift of a Greenland dog with strings of blue beads around its neck to signal that they come in peace.
Well, that's nice.
Yeah. I'm not sure. I mean, if someone gave me a Greenland dog with blue beads around its neck, I wouldn't necessarily think, these people come in peace.
Yeah. Well, I'd have to look it up in the guidebook because I always get confused about blue beads and green beads.
Right, yes,
and
yes,
which
yes.
ones are peace and which ones are total war.
And you can't wear some of these colored beads in parts of LA. When
yeah,
you can
exactly.
Another,
you just don't want to mess with that.
An alternating orange-red is impending nuclear strike, isn't it? And you have to then take immediate action.
If you see a Greenland dog with red and orange beads, get to a bunker.
Well, anyway, in this case, the blue-beaded dogs, the tin can and the food, were untouched hours later.
Mm.
And so they tried different things.
Hang on, I gotta say, so I'm on a boat.
Yep.
I'm a Scottish admiral, whatever, captain, person. Yep. And I'm like sailing along and I'm like, oh, look, people, yep. indigenous people.
Yep. Get the dog.
bring the gift. Yeah, fetch the gifts.
And then
I get in my little boat and I row over and I put the and I place down.
And then you go back to behind a bush.
Yeah.
So this is what I'm trying to work out. So I take the dog and I put it down. I presumably tie it to a thing.
Yeah.
And then I put next to that dog a tin.
Mm-hmm.
And I put next to that dog that was
some clothes.
Some clothes next to the tin.
Yeah.
And then I go behind a bush and I wait.
Yeah.
And then what? Like that's the whole plan is preposterous.
So. Well, it turned out it was preposterous because it didn't come near this obvious trap.
It looks so suspicious.
Anyway, they did manage to lure them out when they started proffering things of greater value, for example, like knives and things like that.
Okay.
They came forward, they saw the knives, they're very excited because, you know, high quality knives. And then they tried to parlay, but they didn't get much out of them. But it turns out that these were the last contacted North American indigenous people by Europeans.
Oh.
So they had never previously been contacted.
Huh.
And just happened to stumble upon in this
Is that right? Really?
Apparently, yeah.
Interesting.
That's interesting. Yeah, 1818. Or possibly. Are we in 1818 right now?
1818. Yeah, okay. Yeah. Which is quite light if you think about exploration.
You should celebrate yourself every day, but some days you should celebrate with jewelry. Whether you want to commemorate an unforgettable moment or just bring some added sparkle to your collection, Blue Nile can offer you expert guidance and a wide assortment of jewelry of the highest quality at the best price. Go to BlueNile.com today and experience the ease and convenience of shopping Blue Nile, the original online jeweler since 1999. That's BlueNile.com. BlueNile.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Really.
Yeah, I guess.
All that was left was the Northwest Passage, which we're getting onto right now. So, anyway, after moving on, he asked them, where's the Northwest Passage? They looked at him blankly. He concluded that the Lancaster Sound could form no part of any potential passage. And he was really worried about winter setting in the north. As you can imagine, waters freeze over, etc. So he wanted to get out of there quickly. And he made the order to turn back. His officers were not happy about this, least of all his friend and compatriot, Captain William Edward Perry of the other ship, because they had seen mountains that fell away into the distance on either side, which could potentially speak to a passage.
Okay.
He ignored them and he, you know, gave the orders and, you know, them's the breaks, unfortunately. He turned around and went back to the UK.
Hmm.
When he got back to the UK, though, he was vilified in public forums and publicly challenged, humiliated by his crew. Articles were published calling him a coward, questioning his honour and his leadership, etc.
Everyone switched the beads on their Greenland dogs. Yeah. Purple, the colour of shame.
And he lost the favour of the Admiralty, and the Admiralty turned to Captain Parry and immediately set him out on another expedition. Just change his socks, whatever, and out you go again.
Okay, so just carry on.
Well, you're not going to go with the same socks, are you?
Well, you got to change your socks, but you also have to refill your tinctures.
Oh, yeah.
If you don't, you're just setting yourself up.
So if I'm the Lord of the Admiralty, I'm just saying to him, like, all right, big fella, change your socks, now you go again.
I think he probably had a break of, like, you know, four days.
Yeah.
Okay. A long weekend in Plymouth or something.
That'll recharge the soul.
So he went out and he was determined to find the passage and prove his compatriot John wrong. And he strayed deeper into the sound and he was getting there. And then winter hit.
Oh.
Totally unpredictable.
Yeah. Totally unpredictable this time of year. Him and his men were trapped in the ice for 10 months.
Oof.
3 months of which were in total darkness because they were so far north.
Oh, God.
But morale was kept high because they were kept busy with regular exercise, plays put on by the officers.
Yes.
And a newspaper.
Wow.
Yes.
What parallels.
Absolute parallels to our Antarctic expedition from
previous episode.
Yeah,
1902, if you want to go listen to it.
Yeah. Things were going great until scurvy set in.
Parallels.
As the spring thaw was hitting, scurvy set in because they'd been away from their land, loved ones, Plymouth, and like lemons for a very long time.
Yeah.
But eventually started melting and they got back 10 months later and they only lost one man. So a strong testament to the teamwork and the crew and stuff as well. And the power of tinned provisions that take ages to open.
That's what they spent most of the 10 months doing.
Exactly.
They should have spent more time foraging for those sweet, sweet Canadian limes.
The ice limes.
Yeah, ice limes.
That's more valuable than the Northwest Passage.
So as a result, when they did come back, though, John Ross, his decision-making was slightly vindicated. It was like, you did the right thing, actually, because you came back with all your men. You didn't get your ship stranded, etc.
Yeah.
And he actually came back into favor, and he went on to command another expedition in 1829. And it's a very interesting one. We're not going to go into it because it is way
well
the
outside.
Wrong way.
Yeah.
But it was, by all accounts, quite heroic. He received a knighthood for it. But it was unsuccessful because he got frozen in too. And they had to disassemble the ship and move it across the thing. And it was a whole kind of thing. Anyway, but suffice to say, the Northwest Passage was not discovered at this time. And it didn't actually get discovered until 1906 by a Norwegian.
Mm.
So the British Admiralty were not happy with that.
Oh dear.
That sucks because I think it was a Norwegian who eventually made it to the South Pole first too.
It was, yeah. Amundsen.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, this guy was called Roald Amundsen.
Oh, it's the same guy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
The guy.
What a
1906,
hero.
Good knowledge. And it was in a ship called a Gjoa, maybe. G-J-O-A. Pronunciations, please, in the back of postcards. Guess what type of ship it was?
A floating one.
It was a sloop.
A sloop.
It was not a sloop.
It was a sloop.
Our favorite type of ship.
Our favorite type of ship. They're scattered throughout history. The sloop is built empires. Anyway, that's my story of the attempted passage through the Northwest Passage that failed.
Wonderful stuff.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Excellent. I just... Man.
Is that just...
Good
is there
point.
A
good point.
I'm at a loss for words.
There's something wonderfully Eurocentric about the term Northwest Passage, isn't there?
Yeah,
it's sort of like everything about it is just fairly awful.
Like those indigenous people just called it the passage.
Yeah, like, yeah, just like that.
The
bit
central
of
passage.
Sea.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. The sea in front of where I live.
Yeah, like, yeah. Yeah. Oh, it's so good. And the, you know, Santa Claus called it the Southwest Passage.
He does.
Well, Southeast, I suppose, depending on where he's standing.
Well, everything's south of Ray's, darling.
That's true. Yeah. It's our first mention of Santa on the podcast.
Greatest historical figure.
Yeah. I can't wait until we get his year.
Yeah, well, it's going to be good when we finally get the year 1953. We'll be able to do Santa because it was the year he was born.
Fascinating.
Wow.
I am going to cover the Seminole Wars, and the Seminole people are an American Indian people, and in particular, I'm going to cover the war that was going on around this particular time. So there was the First Seminole War, which took place a couple of years either side of 1818. And it's a topic that is really kind of fascinating, but it's also one that is fairly tragic, and also one that's, for especially for Americans, it's a live and politically charged topic today. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because the Seminole people very much still exist, and we'll come to why and how they still exist in a moment. So without rehearsing everything about US history in its entirety, suffice it to say that by 1818, the US had, you know, they'd well and truly established their independence, and they'd begun to assert their control over continental America in a bunch of conflicts that followed the Wars of Independence. And this you know, it's a multi-decade process, clearly, that at the War of 1812, which to some degree was about establishing their rights to dominate what's now northeast of the modern US. Do you correct me on any of this?
I
US
mean, all of it's
great.
What I'm hearing is by 1818, America was already a global superpower.
And a quick question, Will.
Yeah.
As a very British-centric monarchist, yeah, how do you feel about America's independence at this time? Pro?
This feels like a trap.
Yeah, because there are some. I'm reluctant to be super pro-American, knowing what you're about to discuss.
So we'll discuss this. So this is a really important point, and I genuinely find this quite interesting, like the extent to which, as a modern American, you can really feel any kind of affinity to the way America was behaving at this time, yeah, particularly yeah, within regard to stories like this. Because I think, and this is as a Brit growing up, you don't learn about any of this stuff. Yeah. So learning about it now is really interesting, because there at this period of history for the Americans, there's almost no difference between the way the US is acting and lots of other continental land powers have acted throughout history. It's in my view, it's just purely imperialist expansionist,
yeah,
behavior.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And basically systematic, like literally systematic genocide of the peoples, yeah, around you in order to expand. And that is basically what's going on during this decade and the following few decades in these sorts of areas, particularly around like their treatment of indigenous peoples. So the Seminole people at this time were the people who were indigenous to the modern day area of northern Florida, south and southeast Georgia, and they were culturally related to the Muskogee Creek people. Who at the time lived in what is now Tennessee and Alabama and Georgia, and then parts of northern Florida as well. And the Seminole people emerged as a distinct, separate people with their own identity, mm-hmm, from that wider Muskogee Creek people at some previous point in time. But they're very much culturally related and related in terms of their traditions and things like that. And in fact, one of the reasons sources suggest why they emerged as a separate grouping was because some of the other tribes in the area had begun to adopt quite a few of the customs and traditions of the European settlers that they were increasingly encountering. So there was a bit of a rejection of the European ways of life, which then informed their later desire to be independent and remain independent, because they kind of rejected that actively. And specifically, lots of the other Native American tribes had been, or a few of them had started to take in black slaves themselves and be slaveholding, and adopt some of the wider slaveholding economic systems of the European settlers in the South. So again, like the Seminole people rejected that as well.
Interesting.
And which is one of the reasons, amongst a whole bunch of reasons, why they started to emerge and have a separate set of traditions. So here we are. So the US is looking to assert its control of the whole continent eventually, and the Seminole people are basically in the way. Like lots of people found themselves in the way. And at this point, enter Andrew Jackson.
Boo.
And Andrew, Andrew Jackson was later a US president, and he, as a president, certainly he was very populist and frankly a bit of a demagogue, and he is someone who has been compared by some to people like to Trump, perhaps. And at this time, though, he was a US general in the US military.
Was his hat just said, "Make America"?
Very good.
That is very good.
That's pretty funny. So whilst there was a general expansion of settlers into Indian land, there were also a few specific flashpoints that triggered the conflict between the US military and the US government and the Seminole people. So the first was that the Seminole people had taken in some of those escaped slaves, which for the US government at the time, but bearing in mind this is, what, 50 years before the Civil War, you know, there's reasonable consensus around the rights of the Southern states to and Southern colonists to hold slaves. So the US government saw that as a big threat to their economic viability. And so they wanted to go and stop them taking in the freed slaves.
So it was actually criminal for them to take slaves in that were at that time seen to be technically property or something?
Exactly.
Like
So you'd, and for a whole bunch of reasons, appalling reasons, escaped slaves were treated in the harshest possible manner to deter others from rising up. And later on, I don't actually know the stats for here, but I think by the time of the Civil War, like I think it was, Anna might know this, like the vast majority of the population of the South in America was slave rather than free people, or it's certainly like a very significant number of them. Basically, and it was the same in Rome, I think, as well, back in the day, where like the people are just living in constant fear of a slave revolt. The other reason was that the Seminole people were reacting against all the European settlers coming in, and they were doing that by raiding those settlers and attacking them, and they were doing some of those attacks in really appalling ways. Absolutely no prisoners taken, women and children were being killed, and so the Seminole people were not just passive victims of what was going on. You know, they're active, and in some ways, in some localized incidents, not to excuse their general genocide against them by the Americans at the time, but they themselves were also doing in local ways quite appalling things.
Yeah. Did the American settlers attempt to leave any dogs with beads?
Had they just not put the right beads on?
Yeah, there could be a whole misunderstanding there. Yeah.
I don't know. I don't think if anyone's investigated that particular route.
Yeah, this could be a really interesting area of original scholarship.
There's a PhD in this, I think.
Yeah.
It's a really interesting point of history and quite uncomfortable for a lot of people to think about that, you know, the great American power that is still founded on some absolutely horrific and, imperialistic.
Oh, totally.
And earlier you said, you know, you didn't learn about this at all as British people growing up. Like, I mean, Americans learn about it, but not in the way that we should. It's not like, and then the US government perpetrated a genocide against an entire.
Yeah, it is unambiguous. Yeah. It's unambiguously genocide.
It's like, oh, there's a trail of tears because it was sad. They had to go to reservations. It's like, no, it was so much worse than that.
Yeah. And so Jackson here is ordered by the US government to take control of this situation because you've got the Seminoles raiding lots of the colonists.
They're not colonists at this time.
Yeah, fair enough. Yeah, okay, but they sort of are in the sense that they're settling what is unsettled land.
Yeah,
from
they're
European
American
perspective.
Settlers now, not
I think that's reasonable. Yeah. So that's fair enough. Yeah, American settlers.
Yeah, you lost that war.
Yeah. They spelled like night and color different, so you can tell the difference between them and European.
Yeah, yeah. We cast off the yoke of your ewes.
What happened was that with a lot of other Indian tribes was that eventually they would fiercely resist initially. And then when the US military began to deploy the full range of its capabilities, they would see that the writing was on the wall and they'd cut some kind of a deal. But the Seminole people were people who chose not to cut a deal, certainly at this particular period. And eventually that meant that this became the most costly war between the US government, US forces, and the American Indians, or any kind. So it inflicted the most casualties on the US side overall, and
on the US side.
On the US side,
In
terms of its costliness,
because
they just wouldn't, because they had such an independent mindset, they wouldn't back off.
I mean, that tracks right with all of their the reason they stayed independent and were rejecting the European encroachment.
And just think of the incredible bravery and, you know, diehard mentality when you're facing this modern military with all the, you know, accoutrements, cannon, muskets, all that kind of things. And your access to arms must be pretty limited, I would assume.
Yeah, I think so.
And still fighting for your
poor quality tinctures. Yeah. And there's so much to say about the Seminole people. So I might have to return to it another time because much happened in the following two or three decades. But in a bit of a postscript, just to take a look at it here, what happened, a little bit of what happened later. So the US eventually then took possession of Florida from Spain, who had a claim to it at this time.
Yeah.
And so they took possession of it in 1821. Though, of course, the Spanish themselves are just like claiming this land where other people have already lived. And so after 1821, the Americans then really wanted to settle that land because they'd just purchased it. And so they then really started to make concerted efforts to attack and push out the indigenous peoples. And then in 1832, they then made a deal to transplant a whole swathe of these people, both a bunch of people from the Seminole tribes who did cut a deal, and the adjacent peoples as well, in terms of the culturally and geographically adjacent people. So about 60,000 in total, and transplant them all up to Oklahoma to give them different lands to go and settle in, which were at the time lands that America had absolutely no priority against settling themselves.
So they wanted
to go and put them up there. And that's what then became known as the Indian removal, and the journey then became known as the Trail of Tears, as Anna mentioned earlier, because of the general tragedy and the hardship of everything they went through being displaced. So,
and then having to end up in Oklahoma. I mean, I'm from Kansas, so Oklahoma is pretty much the only people I can dunk on.
I know nothing about Oklahoma. Give me one hot fact about Oklahoma.
Dust.
Okay, good. Dust.
Tornadoes?
Yeah, tornadoes.
That's a thing.
That whip up the dust.
All that dust in your eyes from the tornado as well.
It's just, the thing is, it's just sort of flat nothingness.
Okay, fine.
Yeah. Fracking.
Fracking?
It's where all the fracking happens. Okay.
Extract all that dust.
Yeah.
The deep wells of dust.
Shale oil dust.
Yeah. It's really interesting to be on the outside of someone from Kansas dunking on Oklahoma and seeing what gets picked up on.
I mean, legitimately, it's the only, like, I can sort of dunk on Nebraska, but like.
What would the UK equivalent of Oklahoma be?
Ooh, interesting.
Is there one?
Like something outside of Peterborough.
Okay, notably dusty.
Well, I'm just trying to think of the flattest part of the UK. Like, like Norfolk, Suffolk, Lincolnshire, just sort of, it's not interesting. Sorry to any of our listeners in that part of the country.
Wow.
Yeah.
Oh, well, if you think you have an equivalent of Oklahoma in your country of
Yes, again, to
residence?
The president of Chile, if you would like to opine on Oklahoma.
What's the Oklahoma of Chile?
Oh, God.
Yeah, I would like to encourage one-word emails in, which are just a single place in the United Kingdom. And we will interpret those one-word emails as being the equivalent of Oklahoma. Yeah. So what was going on here absolutely amounts to what you these days you'd call ethnic cleansing. And under the genocide and under international law now, it's absolutely genocide. And so there's no doubt about that whatsoever. But to finish on a happier note, there were many Seminole people who didn't give in and didn't allow themselves to be displaced, and who kept up their independence and went to live in the Everglades and continued to fight back occasionally. And the descendants from those people still live in Florida in Indian reserves today, after finally being recognized in the 1950s. And that most people consider those descendants and those people living in Florida to be the last remnants of American Indians who have never made any kind of deal with the US government or surrendered in any way whatsoever.
That's awesome.
And they still live in their reserves today and are a proud and independent people with this rich heritage they've maintained for these hundreds of years. So there you are, the Seminole people. Pretty cool, pretty fascinating, slightly tragic, but also some things in there pretty inspiring.
Yeah, great. I mean, God, American history. We really haven't covered it so much because we haven't, it hasn't come up in the random
That's
number
because
generator.
It's an extremely young country.
Yeah, I know.
Most
it's
of history has happened without America.
It's existed for 14 minutes.
The concept of a dusty Oklahoma was not even fermented in someone's mind.
The Egyptians couldn't conceive of the dustiness.
In fact, they rebelled against the flatness with their pyramids.
Well, there's been dust in Oklahoma since the dawn of time, surely.
We will never know.
We'll never know. Well, actually, for a while, I mean, it was covered. There was a great inland ocean. That's why you can get underwater dinosaur fossils in places like Kansas
underwater
and Oklahoma.
Underwater dinosaurs.
Mm-hmm. Huh? You know, which were called, I don't know, Mosasaur or whatever.
Mosasaur.
Yeah, that's I'm not making that up.
Mosasaurus.
I think that was Mosasaurus. A big underwater dino swimming boy.
Right, well, that's been this year. Thank you very much for listening. Before we go too deep into the paleontology.
Yeah, because that is, I think we can all safely agree, well outside the realm of this podcast.
Millions of years.
I'm so angry with you right now for mentioning dinosaurs.
And the RNG will probably curse us for this.
I know.
I'm changing the beads on my dog right now.
How dare you? I will put purple beads on my dog. I am not afraid of you.
Oh my God.
All right, thanks everyone for joining us. That's everything you'd ever need to know about 1818. As always, we'd love to hear from you, so feel free to get in touch with us. Instagram, Twitter, the website, the Patreon, there are a million ways.
Yeah, tell your friends as well.
Tell your friends.
And also, if you could subscribe and rate, I'll be your friend.
Wow.
Good call to action there, Adam. Yeah.
That's, you guys have no idea how valuable his friendship is. He often takes his shirt off.
I just really want some other friends that aren't the two of you.
Yeah, fair enough.
Can we talk about anything other than history? Please.
Well, I've got my fingers crossed for the president of Chile.
Speaking of history, it's time to choose our next year. Will, as always, you are you were the holder, the heralder of the RNG. Yeah. Can you please
the steward?
Boot it up? The steward, yeah, of the random protector. Number generator. The guardian.
It is a heavy burden.
It is one you bear nobly, sir.
People have asked, actually, we have had a few emails in about the heaviness of the burden.
Would you say it's a yoke?
It's certainly not a yoke. But in answer to these questions that we've been getting in, it does weigh 26 kilograms. That is how heavy the one
that
number generator is.
You've got to keep it on a chain around your neck is admirable.
Yeah.
And
that's
foolish.
The tough bit. Yep, that's the tough bit.
Constantly. <Yeah.
laughs> Especially when you leave the trolley at home. I am firing up the random number generator and feeding it.
I can see it vibrating against your chest.
Feeding it its fuel of tinned goods. And the year is 261 CE.
261.
I'm not going to enjoy this one.
That's going to be grim.
It's early.
Fingers crossed for Rome.
Is Rome still around?
Rome's around.
Okay.
Not peak Rome.
Not peak Rome.
Yeah, it's past its best.
Rome's around, but like Egypt's done.
Yeah.
The Middle East is sort of there.
It's like post Sorkin West Wing Rome.
Yeah, okay. Is Oklahoma a thing? Is it dusty? How's the dust levels?
Oklahoma is somewhere between underwater dinosaurs and copious dust.
Sorry, underwater, we'll never discuss these things again.
All right, I'm so sorry. Oh no, the random number generator.
The trolley's going to knock you over.
It's glaring at me.
Cool. Until next time.
Toot toot.
Bye.
Did you just say toot toot?
Yeah, I don't know what that was.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50. Luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's stamps.com code program.